podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
The following podcast is a member of the Great Big Owl family.
Football is many things. Unpredictable, exciting, colourful, passionate, absorbing, expensive.
Venal, infuriating, exasperating, time-consuming, depressing. But one thing it most certainly is not, is a level playing field.
Welcome to the famous sloping pitch. In a week where we Earthlings received the first pictures back from Saturn, they were actually quite dull, but at least we now know where Danny Drinkwater is.
Also, a week where Newcastle fans can finally start to wonder whether Project Zebra is real or just Project Mule that leaned on a painted fence. A mule with a truly awful human rights record that funded Al-Qaeda, murdered a journalist and pissed off Amnesty International.
Last night, because I was staying with you, Chris, obviously you know that, but watching the Nations League semi-final between Spain and Italy.
Yes.
And I somehow had missed this during the Euros, but the ball was delivered to the centre spot on a tiny remote controlled car.
It wasn't that tiny though, was it? It was almost knee high.
Yeah, it was relatively big, but yeah. It was just, you just think, what? Who thinks that makes the game of football better to have room? And also, the chances of it going wrong are really high, aren't they?
Yeah,
they must have all been in mission control, going slapping each other and doing high fives when it actually reached the centre.
Or there was a tiny little Stig in there.
Yes.
Someone who knew what he was doing.
Yes,
you know.
Yeah.
And just think for how big that car is, how big the grass must have seemed you know, to the car.
Yes, it's Planet of the Giants, isn't
it? Must have been like driving through a cornfield.
Yeah.
You know, for the ball, it's quite an adventure for the ball.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Whereas the ball has in recent years anyway, been quite static at the start of the game on a little plinth for worshipping purposes.
That's right, yes.
But it hasn't had that little adventure.
Yes, I wonder if there are... sort of well-known plinth manufacturers that UEFA have. UEFA
and then they're looking at the football last night saying, what? What's this?
I presume.
We're out of business. If this catches on.
Yeah. And I presumed because it does look ridiculous. And they're also, in the World Cup final, they sometimes put the trophy there, don't they?
Yeah. When Zidane was sent off. He had to walk off past it.
I was imagining that this must be an innovation that they had ages ago, but they had to wait for Gazza to retire. Because the idea of Gazza walking past either the ball or a World Cup without doing something
with
to it.
Walking past a plinth of any kind.
But I was also thinking, just very quickly on the car thing, that you know, it doesn't get enough use. And I was thinking that what they should have is a yellow car and a red car. And when he comes to sort of challenge somebody for a bad foul, the crowd aren't sure if the yellow car or the red car is going to come
on. And if the red car comes on, it's slightly bigger and carries the guy
sends him off.
And it's a red car offence.
It's a red car offence, a yellow car offence and a red car offence.
And there's a tongue twister.
Yeah, watch this space because they will go for that.
Anyway, before we gaze longingly at the glittering gewgaws that have caught our eye in the high-end jewellers of the Premier League, first a quick visit to the 99p store of dreams that is the very bottom of EFL2. Exciting news, Nick.
Go on.
Oldham Athletic managed to claw their way up and off the very bottom rung at the weekend. Yes.
But I thought they lost.
Yeah, on goal difference, by virtue of only losing 2-1 to Harrogate Town.
So who's
bottom?
While
Scunthorpe lost by 3. So it feels like a win.
Yeah.
Or at least as close to a win as we're likely to get at home these days. Because in other exciting news, I found a league table that Oldham are actually top of.
Right.
And no, not just the normal league table that's printed upside down, because Scunthorpe are top of that.
Yeah.
No, it's a table of all the current 92 clubs arranged in order of the very worst home records going back to 2008.
Yeah.
And at the start of the season, accumulating. Yeah. You know, and at the start of the season, Sunderland were top of this one, which is a bit odd, because you kind of think of them as having been, because they've had a couple of seasons up at the top end of League One.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, during that time, we've been steadily catching them up. And they've started this season with 6 straight wins,
ooh,
while Oldham really haven't. And that's enough, apparently, for us to unseat them up there. It won't be long before we have a song about that, I reckon.
No, I just love that. What newspaper do you get that has all these tables in? Because you've always got a table every week where Oldham is near the top.
Yeah, well, I just Google Oldham top of table, and just for nostalgia's sake, if I can find anything in the last 30 years, then I feel like I've had a result.
Or the other thing that would happen is that they would be top of the table, and it'd be like some Richard Curtis film, all the time had passed, and suddenly you awoke in a world where Oldham were top.
One day that will happen. Yeah. I mean, it's a real shame, the home record thing, because Boundary Park used to be such a fortress when I was first watching Oldham. And teams hated coming there because it was reputedly the coldest ground in the country. Joe Royal nicknamed it Ice Station Zebra, if you remember.
Did he?
Yeah, and the corner flanks famously used to fly in four different directions, which is what would normally happen in a tornado. And opposition teams used to hate the plastic pitch that we used to have.
Yeah.
Claimed it gave us an unfair advantage. And we used to love attacking in the second half down our famous sloping pitch, which is sadly no more.
And can I say, I think you've missed out one of the elements that may have made it difficult to visit.
Oh, yeah.
You had some good players.
We had some good players.
You see?
Yes, exactly. But now Oldham's officially the most welcoming club in the country in terms of points per game, anyway. Not in terms of serving beer to the home fans, because the clown owner is paranoid about fueling protests, as if the results on the pitch aren't enough for that. And not in terms of the searches on the way through the turnstiles either, as a much more vigorous approach has been introduced recently.
Has it?
Oh, yeah. Not just the cursory pat down for pop bottles by a teenager doing his 50p an hour Saturday job in return for being allowed to stand with his back to the pitch for the whole game, which is actually more of a bonus than it sounds this season, because the owner is worried about a repeat of the tennis ball protest from earlier in the season. And you wouldn't want that job, would you? You know, patting people down for tennis balls.
No.
Because where are people going to hide tennis balls?
Yes,
excuse me, sir.
And also, you say, sir, we're going to have to throw you out. Excuse me, I've got testicular cancer.
Yes, exactly. Is that? No, that's me.
Okay.
Ah, okay then, respect.
But on the other hand, you know, it's going to be fantastic to be able to say, Boundary Park, the place to come for away teams, where everybody gets a going home present.
gets a bit of a fondle.
Yeah.
Anyway, onto the world of proper football, unfortunately. I mean, more and more it seems to me that the narrative of the Premier League is that these big games, like Liverpool Man City at the weekend, they're portrayed as, and you know, however great the players are, but they're portrayed as a head-to-head mind game contest between iconic managers, the geniuses who are really pulling the strings. Guardiola versus Klopp. And Tuchel versus Benitez or something. Well, exactly, yeah. And this weekend just gone, we had Liverpool-Man City, a week after Chelsea-Man City, and there's a feeling that these games mark the beginning of the actual contest for the league title, after the shadow boxing and fitness building that's gone so far.
Yeah.
Now, this week, the Telegraph managed, this is another table, on the same page, to have a graphic showing that the points gap covering the top six is the smallest ever after seven games.
Yes.
I don't know where they find that.
Yeah.
Go through lots of Rothman's football yearbooks with a pencil and a pad.
Yeah, well, when they say ever, obviously they mean
exactly. I mean, in the history of the Premiership, of course, which is ever in football now.
Yeah.
And the absolute concrete assertion that the current top four will be the top four at the end of the season. It's just a matter of what order. On the same page as saying that they're as close to the rest as they've ever been.
Yeah.
But this is definitely the top four.
It basically said, because I had a look at that, it basically said, you know, nobody can predict what's going to happen this season. But here are our predictions.
Here we are predicting,
and
nothing will change
exactly.
From now until the end of the season. And all of the interesting thing about the top four, because the top four is Chelsea, Liverpool, City, Man United.
Yeah.
The interesting thing is all of their expert pundits were writing off Man United, even though they have Ronaldo and they have Pogba and they have Fernandes and they have Sancho and they have Rashford and they have Greenwood. And why? Because they don't have a genius tactician in charge. They have Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, who no one thinks is quite up to it.
Yeah.
And it's because everything is now wrapped up in the contests between these iconic managers.
Yes.
Guardiola, of course, is the archetypal genius. And for some reason, Man City were given a points victory by the judges after Sunday's big game. And I watched that game. It was a terrific game.
It was a great
terrific
great game.
Game. And a draw, I thought, just about fair result. But Liverpool could have won it. They were ahead with 10 minutes to go.
Mm-hmm.
And it wouldn't have been a steal, I don't think. But no, Pep came out on top, apparently. And certainly he won the tantrum contest, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He definitely
won
that.
As we were treated to a full-on performance of his trademark injustice pantomime, ripping his layers off, waving his arms about, kicking stuff. I loved, do you see this? I'm Mike Dean, the fourth official. It's a completely deadpan reaction to Pep ranting and stomping about.
Yes.
And you didn't have to be much, did you, of a lip reader to see him going, calm down, calm down.
I'm not sure he did it in the accent. But
he must have done, which is the most provocatively Scouse thing he could possibly say, which is top work. I don't really, not a lot of time for Mike Dean, generally speaking, but calm down, calm down.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good effort from the boy. Effort. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, in a way, Guardiola had a point. You know, Milner should have gone off, I think. But yeah. I do like Milner. He's like, he's made of rock.
Oh, yes, and also, like, you know, and also I remember that he was the youngest Premier League player for many, many, many
years. Well, he was the youngest scorer, I think, and took over from Rooney. Rooney had just.
Did he?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, I thought he played before Rooney.
No, I think they're contemporary, and Milner's just slightly younger.
There'll be a table.
There'll be a table somewhere.
Exactly. Just on the subject of Solskjaer, I mean, I think the thing about Solskjaer is that he does lots of interviews, but he's quite quiet and doesn't seem very confident, which is why he can't be one of the big hitters, whereas Guardiola and Klopp talk a lot, and Tuchel, it seems, doesn't talk at all.
Well, the experts love Tuchel as well, don't they? Even though he seemed to bottle that Man City game a bit.
Yeah.
And he started, after starting very positively, to leave Lukaku isolated, play more cautiously, I think.
Yes.
And they lost to Juventus that time, and they were struggling, actually, against Southampton, weren't they, until the VAR sent Ward-Prowse off.
Yes. Yes.
And they reported that thing.
It was red car decision.
Yeah, a red car should have come on and taken him on. Yeah. But they reported that thing he said about thinking Reece James had been called up for the England water polo team, as though it actually worked as a joke.
Yes, which it doesn't at all, does it? No.
But it must be difficult, I think, for Solskjaer. You know, he's got the greatest manager in the club's history. Still comes to all the games, looking over his shoulder, bringing a range of facial expressions varying between sour bellyache when United aren't winning 5-0 and outright astonishment when they are.
Yes, yes.
And he has opinions still, doesn't he, on your team selections, which he's happy to discuss with Khabib Nurmagomedov, a former UFC champion, on his Instagram. Yeah. And do you think that was a mistake? That he thought UFC was some sort of United Football Club channel.
I'm going to speak to UFC.
But he said, didn't he, that you should always start your best players. It was a swipe at Solskjaer, left out Ronaldo and Pogba as well.
And the other side of the Ronaldo story was, it came out this week that Gary Lineker said that Ed Woodward, who's the chief executive at Manchester United.
And the equaliser, of course.
The equaliser, yes, indeed. that he bought Ronaldo in Lineker's garden, which I thought was such a funny... Because, you know, sometimes you go out and you come home with something you hadn't meant to buy. And I can imagine him coming in and his wife going, Ed, what's that? What have you got
there?
What
have you done?
You were meant to go to Lineker's to buy two fence panels and borrow the strimmer. What is it? It's Cristiano Ronaldo.
What do you mean you bought a tractor?
I love the idea he was bought in Lineker's garden. He's got other players there as well.
I like the idea that he's buying Ronaldo on the fact he's doing the most important transaction of the transfer window.
Yeah.
And Lineker's mouthing at him, cup of tea? Cup of tea? You want a cup of tea?
Yes. Sausage and chicken?
And Solskjaer, didn't he, told an interviewer after the game, me and him, meaning himself and Cristiano, no better than you journalists and experts.
Which,
you know, it may be true, but it makes you sound like a massive tool when you say it out loud.
It's a little bit feeble, isn't it?
Yeah, and all the experts were surprised that Ronaldo was benched to manage his energy levels, particularly when he looks like he's been carved out of half a ton of raw stamina.
Yes.
Yes. And he has been accused, though, a bit of playing walking football lately, hasn't he?
Well, he gets tired, though, doesn't he? Because he has to stand on a plinth outside of Old Trafford all week long.
And then sometimes on the plinth in Madeira as well.
Yes.
Oh, what a brass neck that guy's got. But anyway, I think it's interesting to consider, as we will now, in the context of managers as figureheads thing, the particular case of Watford
at
the moment. Because, you know, the sack race suddenly over, as if Cisco Munoz was shot by the starter's pistol. You know, the managerial merry-go-round barely got going before one of the gaudily painted wooden horses has attacked Cisco Munoz and kicked him into the guess your weight booth. I mean, the thing about Watford, when they sack a coach, they like to be able to say, farewell, we hardly knew you.
Yes.
Don't they?
Yes.
Because it's very hard for a manager to last, any period of time.
Yes, but what's interesting, I think, about the media's response is that they're responding to a different sort of a setup. So this isn't a scandal. This is a philosophy that Watford have.
Yes.
You know, and I have a few friends who are Watford fans, and they say that they're bored about every time they get this ignorant response when a head coach, and bear in mind they use the phrase head coach mostly at Watford rather than manager, leaves, that everyone goes, oh no, they should have been given more time. Well, that's not the model that
the Pozzo family
use. You know, and I'm speaking to my friend Ollie Wicken, who does Hornet Heaven, that's his podcast, and he was saying, you know, it's difficult to get used to, but this is the model that they have used at Udinese and at Granada, and that is often used in Italy, and in fact is the model that Chelsea use.
It is, to a slightly sort of slower extent, I think. I mean, but they're dealing with, I think, at Chelsea, they're dealing with trying to establish the figurehead thing. What they're looking for at Chelsea is someone with a personality, that's going to be a figurehead for the club. And what Watford are looking for basically is more and more is someone you've never heard of who's going to be like a charisma vacuum.
Yeah.
And you know, the Cisco Muniz has had some terrific results, particularly in the promotion season. Season last season, but this season he doesn't really work. Because you put his picture up, no one knows where the hell he is, and they're never gonna know him.
Are you suggesting that they could actually have swapped him and nobody would have known?
Well, they could have swapped him for, let's see, Giuseppe Sanino.
Yeah.
You know, Quique Sanchez Flores. These are interchangeable people.
Yeah,
Marco Silva, Javi Gracia. Quique Sanchez Flores again.
Yes.
You know.
And Sean Dyche doesn't really fit into that.
Well, no, Sean Dyche was their first, I think, the Pozzo's first. He just led Watford to their best finish for 4 years and then sacked, was new broomed.
Yeah.
And the thing is, he went to Burnley and has been there ever since. And in the time he's been at Burnley, Watford have had like 13, 14 managerial changes. And another one, you know, just now.
But the thing that Watford do, and we talked about Moneyball last week, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
The thing that they do is they are constantly searching for players to bring in and invest in order to sell on, you know.
Yeah,
and
lots
of them won't work. And then they'll have a Richarlison, you know, who they can sell on for an awful lot of money. And that's how it works. But apparently they have the same pattern for managers, for head coaches.
Yeah.
They're always looking. They've always got a shortlist.
Mm.
You know, it isn't something you go, oh, wait a minute, we'll have to have a think now. I mean, you notice that they had a bad game at Leeds and everyone, oh, well, that's why he's lost his job. Well, no, he lost his job then because we've got the international break coming up. You know, and Claudio Ranieri was actually sitting in reception.
Yeah. Well, I think Ranieri is a very interesting appointment for Watford because he seems to break the mould a little. You know, people have heard of him for a start.
You know,
and not only that, he's got a couple of really very high-profile lines on his CV. And, you know, Munoz had only had like 5 months at Dynamo Tbilisi, and that was his only managerial credit before he went to Watford. But Ranieri has a couple of quite big lines on his CV. You know, the first manager sacked by Abramovich, for instance, for the egregious sin of not having been appointed by him, and Chelsea was second. And then the miracle at Leicester, where he became a much-loved favourite with neutrals for the giving the players pizza if they won thing, and the saying dilly-ding, dilly-dong, which I see he hasn't been allowed to forget, and because he looks like the Tracy brothers' grandfather in Thunderbirds.
Yes.
And he said he wanted his players to be hungry, 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 in the voice of the dog off of That's Life that said sausages.
Yes, and also, surely after hungry, hungry, hungry comes the word hippos,
there's the word hippos, yeah.
That's what I've always thought.
Yeah, yeah, there's a slip-up there.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's not, I think, the Leicester miracle that makes him Watford material. It's his track record since, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's 12 games at Roma, 17 games at Fulham, a few months at Nantes, a couple of faintly disappointing mid-table finishes at Sampdoria.
Yeah.
He feels dispensable nowadays and a figurehead at the same time.
I mean,
he feels like 36 games from retirement.
Yeah, well, and that list you've just given there, you know, that's not a career. That's the Grand Tour is what he's doing there.
Yeah.
The other thing is, actually, which is quite pertinent to what happening at Newcastle, because this is the way that they work, they know there's going to be a churn, they don't have these managers on incredibly long, incredibly expensive contracts.
And
Ashley said, well, yeah, whatever you think about Steve Bruce, we can't get rid of him because we can't afford to get rid of him.
And
you hear this time and time and time again.
Well, and especially lower down the leagues, because that's the trade-off.
Yeah.
That, you know, if say you're Oldham and you want a manager as experienced as Keith Curl,
Yeah.
And you can, you know, you can have him if you like, but you know, you need to give him 2 years, or he's not going to consider it. You know?
Yeah.
And then you can't get shot of him.
So, but you know. and the other thing that doesn't fit that new model is the old idea that you have to give manager time. You know, and they'll always quote Adrian Heath's goal against Oxford for Everton, which turned it for Howard Wilkinson.
Or Mark Robbins.
Or Mark Robbins scoring for Manchester United the same round against Oldham Athletic.
Well,
currently,
but
91st.
He had a goal against Forest in the third round that was the real turning point for Ferguson, I think.
Yes.
Ferguson was under pressure over that Christmas.
Yes.
And then in that January, I think he scored in the third round. He scored again in the semi-final replay.
Yeah.
But
the whole thing about that was, if we can only give these managers more time, then it will come right. They'll have time to sort out who they want in the squad. Well, the other thing about that is, it isn't up to the managers half the time who's in the squad.
No.
I mean, to a certain extent.
Unless they're if they don't let them be in charge of recruitment.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
I think that I enjoyed, I must say, Match of the Day 2 playing out on the Saturday, I'm not usually still awake for. But they played out with, you know, celebrity fan Elton John over a montage of Watford management. And the words, maybe you'll get a replacement. There's plenty like me to be found. Mongrels who ain't got a penny, sniffing for titbits like me on the ground.
Yes. Which you've got to think Claudio Ranieri is going to balk at a little bit.
I know, but they must have been so pleased when they came up with that.
Yeah,
and, you know, kudos to them.
Now, the other thing which we should cover is Terry Butcher's contention that it's time to end heading. It's the end of heading in football.
Well, for a few years now, the family of Jeff Astle have been campaigning, haven't they, to raise awareness of the fact that footballers are far more likely to suffer from dementia in later life as a result of repeated brain trauma caused by heading the ball.
Yep.
I mean, five times as likely as non-footballers of similar age.
Yep.
And more old favourites have come forward, haven't they, with their diagnoses, sadly, I mean, including several members of the 1966 World Cup winning squad, Wilson, Stiles, Peters, both the Charltons, I think.
Yep.
And the game has seemed, finally, to have started tentatively inching towards wondering what could be done about this. And that last week there was this experimental match.
Well, yeah. First of all, we both accept that this is clearly an awful subject and a distressing subject.
If there's something that can be done about it,
That's great.
You know.
So what the idea is, what will football look like, isn't it, with that head?
It is. And you know, you could make the argument that that these old players were playing under slightly different conditions.
Yes, they were. Yeah, yeah.
That the ball was much heavier. And I don't know about in the 60s, but certainly before that, the ball was leather with laces
and soaked up water
and weighed a ton would actually, you know, come close to knocking people out who tried to head it.
Yeah,
you know. But as I say, last week there was this experimental match up at Spennymoor, between Spennymoor and a Middlesbrough
old boys
11,
yeah,
to see what football would look like, in theory, if heading the ball was reduced or actually eliminated altogether. And in the first half, they allowed heading, but only in the penalty area. And this meant that crosses from the wing were still part of the attack, defensive headers still vital, corners are still a threat if you do that. Mm-hmm. But it cut out the most dangerous headers, which I think are the ones where the players are competing for a long kick upfield out of the keeper's hands, or from an unsophisticated hoofed clearance by someone else.
Yeah.
And these, in this trial game, these had to bounce or be brought down on the chest, possibly, before they could be challenged for. And if someone inadvertently headed it, it's a free kick. It's like a handball free kick, a headball free kick, and then the red car comes on and takes someone on.
Deliberate
headball. But in the second half, it was the same game, same teams, but there was no heading at all.
Yeah.
And just to see what that looked like and see how that played. And the reports for that part of the match were less encouraging, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to bear in mind that some of the old boys were probably a bit tired by then.
Yeah.
But, you know, comments included, it was like walking football, or it was like a sort of incompetent tiki-taka, you know, which God knows is tedious enough when it's done well.
You know. I mean, but the other thing was, I think in the first part, I don't know whether you did say this, but they were allowed to head it in the area.
Yes, in the penalty area.
In the penalty area, they were allowed to head it, which in itself is a very interesting thing, because you're going to get this VAR thing, aren't
you? Well, it's going to be a line call, isn't it?
Yeah, and you're going to have hair
on the edge.
yeah. the chin, does the chin count, does the ear count?
Yeah, yeah.
You're going to get all of that stuff.
And whether the guy's headed it, and his head's in the area, but his feet are outside the area. Also,
yeah.
And there's so many times, you know, that line call is ignored, isn't it? When the keeper throws it, is kicking out of his hands,
yeah.
and he's come out of the area, and his hands are beyond the line, clearly. Yeah.
But the other thing, I mean, the other thing clearly that could happen if they were properly designed is helmets.
Well, there are other sports, aren't there? Other sports where there's a risk of head trauma. You know, how many other sports really use the head, though, as part of the thing? But plenty protect the head with helmets. Cricket, you know, gridiron football in America. Cycling, of course.
But skiing.
Skiing, yeah. Rugby players, though, you know, have to stick their heads into mauls and scrums with that protection. I think neck injuries are a more common problem in rugby. But there are, you know, how many other sports even use whether, you know, you could use some sort of protective headgear and still head the ball. Maybe that's another thing they could look at that would cushion the impact.
But the other thing is, you know, it's not completely unheard of. There's been plenty of players I know that have never used their head and also players that never use their left foot as well. So, you know, you can take different things out.
There are life-threatening injuries, you know,
All over the pitch and all over the body.
That are due to competing for headers, you know. Raul Jimenez had that, which a doctor said he was lucky to survive.
Head-to-head collision. Check.
Which wasn't even, you know, competing for a header.
No, it was down low.
And I think Ryan Mason have a career-ending skull injury,
possibly.
I think that's why he stopped playing.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think it would make a lot of difference to Oldham. I haven't seen anyone, apart from our centre backs, I haven't seen anyone win a header all season. But I think it's interesting. I mean, it'd be interesting to see, I think, the first half where what they did at Spennymoor, where you were allowed to head in the penalty area, and see whether that felt like. I mean, there was a trial game, wasn't there, years ago, I remember, for offside. Was only 30 yards
from another offside line, wasn't
they'd
it?
They'd had another
line. I think
line.
They actually did it in some cup competition in Scotland, possibly.
Did they?
Yeah. I think they did.
Yeah.
I may have just dreamt that. I don't know. I dream a lot of stuff.
Do you dream about Scottish football a lot?
I do, actually. Yeah.
More than I should.
It's my filthy secret. Yeah, I often wake up shouting Stenhouse Muir.
Kind beef.
Anyway, we better draw a line under it there, and in a moment we'll have our guest. Well, our guest today has an impeccable football education, working with legendary manager Jim Smith, ex-England boss Steve McLaren, and enjoying stints at Derby, Southampton, Sunderland, Stoke and Burton. Also involved with the Republic of Ireland, she and her family now stretch across the football nation and generations from Burton Albion to Manchester City. She's also witnessed me do a less than impressive impression of ex-England coach Steve Harrison, involving a bucket, a boat and the River Seine. But that's best left alone. Welcome to Helen DeLapp.
Thank you.
Hello, Helen.
Hi.
Now, I'm really looking forward to getting some insights into, you know, how it works when virtually your whole family are involved in the game of football. But first of all, I want to know how you came into it, because football didn't come to you. You went to football, didn't you?
Yeah, completely. It was out of fluke, really. My mum has always been involved in sport. She was the England cricket physio.
Oh,
and when I decided that I was going to go down the sports therapy route, when I came out, I was just looking for some work experience, really, and started working sort of a proper job, but then also was working at the cricket club as well, and really enjoyed it. Got a job there sort of over the summer and was thoroughly enjoying it. But then Derby County rang and said that they were looking for someone. And so had they got anyone? Because obviously the cricket sort of finished over the summer and then...
Was it Derbyshire?
Yeah, Derbyshire County Cricket Club.
So that makes
sense. Yeah, so I was working for Derbyshire County Cricket Club.
Yeah.
Derby County came in. I went on trial with, there was three of us actually, there was two men and me. And I went for a week and they all went for a week. And I never heard anything. So to be honest, I thought Jim's going to pick. Because women in football back then was really quite unusual.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was laying in the bath and then he rang me and he was like, do you want the job? And it started off with just going in part-time, doing a bit, but then very quickly became full-time, travelling with the team and everything else.
So were you literally doing the running onto the pitch? Or
no, there was a man called Peter Melville that did that. He was the chartered physio. I was just the sports therapist.
Okay.
So it's like the sports massage, rehab, Okay. I mean, God, I used to teach step aerobics to the rehab boys. Just as a bit of a joke, really.
Tell me, there must have been some incredibly clumsy players doing that, weren't there?
There was some very clumsy players, but I tell you what, we had a lot of Italians back then, so there were some very, very good movers. Paolo Wanchope was one of the best movers of all.
Well, he's not Italian, he's from Costa Rica.
I know, but then there's Arano, Barano, yeah.
Oh, that's good. And tell me about this. Was the skill set different? Coming from cricket, which I imagine was a lot of sort of shin splints and all that sort of stuff, and you're suddenly into football. Was it a very different sort of discipline?
It was really, because back then with the cricket, it wasn't as professional. I mean, one of my first memories is it was the Benson and Hedges Cup, and obviously they were all in the dressing room, and the Benson and Hedges sponsors come in through the fags, and it was just like free for all. It was how many you could get at once. So it wasn't really very professional when you went to the football. And I think back then, Jim Smith and Steve McLaren especially, was incredibly ahead of the game with regards to the coaching side of it. So we had like the Pro Zone. It was very, very ahead of the game. So we were
okay, Pro Zone. Yeah, that was there.
We were quite professional, I would say, in the medical department.
So was it rehab that you were doing for injured players?
Yes, it was rehab for the injured players, but then also obviously for the fit players, just the basic sports massage. If they'd had a game midweek, they would have.
So you would deal with all of the players, not just the injured players.
Yeah.
So I was wondering whether there were more injury-prone players that you would get to know a lot better.
Yeah, you did. You did. But to be honest, it tended to be the young lads as well, because they hadn't got families to go home to, so they'd just come and see you more for a crack after the, you know, training. Oh, okay. And we just sort of all, it was a really, really, really family atmosphere back then.
That's an interesting thing, actually, I mean, the idea of one of the family thing, but also of you having like another level of responsibility, which was to help their mental health, I suppose, in a way. Especially
I reckon
youngsters.
Back then it was more, I think they came to me more as a therapy side, because they could moan to me and they knew it wouldn't go back to the manager. Yeah, whereas in the physio room sometimes, or maybe in the coaching rooms, it might, but it literally was like a safe haven. I had my own little room. They used to come in. They'd be all in there.
Was it Helen's confessional?
It was literally, yeah. I mean, God, I've got a lot of stories.
Well, look, this is the place to tell them. Right, so we need to move on, obviously, to, so then you meet a young Cumbrian, Mr. Delap.
Simon Mayo music.
We don't need the full R tune bit here.
Right. Well, Jim always said, he was like, oh, whatever you do, don't like go and meet one of the players, blah, 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 because that'll just prove everybody wrong that I've hired a woman.
Yeah.
And then obviously Rory arrived, and you know, it wasn't anything like that for a while, and then it was just one drunken night, unfortunately, and then that was it.
Okay, we won't go any further. let's move on to a situation where you've been together for some time, and I'm just interested very much in the way that football impacts the whole family, because you know, us as supporters, we might watch the players 2 hours of the week, they're probably with their teammates 20 hours a week, but when, and especially with your family, which we'll talk about later, which goes broader, when every single decision is both football and family, it must make it difficult. So let's, for instance, go to Rory's first transfer to Southampton. Now, for a fan, you know, you just see Rory Delap's going from Derby to Southampton. But for you, I mean, when do you get the first inkling? How do you decide together? What are the problems that crop up?
I've never really ever got involved with that.
Okay.
I've trusted him. It's his decision, because it's his footballing decision, and he kind of knows I'm the kind of person that will just be happy with as long as he's happy. Uh-huh. Obviously, with Southampton, it was slightly different, because he just signed a 3-year contract at Derby, so it came completely out of the blue. We just arrived back from holiday, landed at Heathrow, driving up the motorway back home. Jim rang and was like, can you get back? I dropped him off literally back at Heathrow, and he flew off pre-season. So it was, you know, a bit of a shock, but it was possibly one of the best decisions. And I think it really, because I don't think really Rory really wanted to go, I think it was Jim. Jim was just, go, this is an opportunity of a lifetime. And he went, and it was fantastic. And, you know, going down to the South Coast, it is literally, you know, it's beautiful as well. So,
yeah, but that's an interesting thing you say about Jim Smith saying to him, you know, this is going to be a good move for you, blah, blah. I'm sure that isn't always the case at clubs. I'm sure sometimes they want to hang on to.
No, he was a special man, though. Yeah, he really was a special man. And he genuinely, I think, had our best interests at heart. He knew kind of what was going on behind the scenes. Yeah. Derby kind of ended up in a bit of a quandary afterwards, and it was the best move at the time.
It sounds very nice that he should be so sort of solicitous of your well-being. I mean, I've heard stories about managers who deliberately keep a distance from the players because they know they have to treat them as a commodity at some point in their lives, and it's nice that you had that relationship.
Yeah. He really was. Well, but then maybe I worked with him, so it was maybe different.
Yes, of course, you were working with him as well.
You had your own relationship. Yeah. And of course, by then, Jim had been around the block a long time. Yeah. Now, when you went to Southampton, had you any children?
No.
So the next move is Sunderland.
Yeah.
Is it not? Had you any children by then?
Yes, two.
Yes. So therefore, that's a different kind of a deal.
Yeah, that was really weird.
Right,
okay. Because we were literally January deadline day, walking along the seafront with the dog and the two boys, 3 and 1 at the time. I think we got a phone call at about 4 o'clock. I think Rory was on a plane to Sunderland at 5 o'clock and didn't come back. And, well, the funniest thing was, is obviously I just let him go off, and he was staying in Seaham Hotel, I think it was called at the time. And it was my eldest birthday in February. So I said, right, well, go up, get yourself sorted, and I'll come up for his birthday. And they'd never seen snow before. And we landed, got into Sunderland, and it was like, absolutely thick, yeah, yeah. And they were like, oh my god, this is amazing. Like, the kids were literally, after 2 days, they went, can we go home now? It was, but
well, yes, when you're 3 and 1, you're quite small, the snow seems very high.
Yeah. But to be honest, that was very, you know, it was out of the blue, but it was closer to his family. It was, you know, move
just across the A66, I imagine.
Yeah. So, but then it didn't last very long, so
no, but just. So one other thing on that whole thing. So you moved to Southampton, you've moved to Sunderland. Shortly we're going to talk about Stoke. But how have you found different clubs help you to integrate into, A, the local community, and two, into the community of the club itself? I presume they're all different, aren't they?
Yeah, well, Southampton was quite interesting because obviously we didn't have the kids, so it was slightly different. But the captain at the time and his wife, Fran and Karen Bernali, they took us out for dinner with a couple of the other players and wives. Yeah. And that was brilliant because it just meant that when you went on match day, you weren't walking in not knowing anyone on that first day. So that was great. And it made you feel very welcome. When we went up to Sunderland, I have to say there was nothing, but it was in a bit of a funny time at Sunderland where he signed for Mick McCarthy, and obviously on the pretext that he wasn't going to get sacked. And then literally he was sacked quite soon afterwards. Yeah. And they were on a relegation season. So I would say the atmosphere wasn't great up there. The only thing I would say is that Roy Keane was the manager when we actually left. And I have to say he was really good because there was a few things going on. I'd actually ended up miscarrying when there was maybe a bit of a club move happening mm-hmm. up there, and he was just like amazing. Right. I can remember Rory coming home saying, he just said, take your time, do what you need to do. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as regards to integrating into the team, I was a lot older than a lot of them then. A lot of the girls were a lot younger.
Yeah.
But also they were in a bit of a
they're in a pickle. Yeah. And of course that affects everybody, doesn't it? And that's part of the thing I'm interested in from a family point of view. You know, the kids are getting older.
Yeah.
Obviously, the things that happen in the games, the things that are happening around the club, if the kids are at school, for instance, nearby, there must be pressures there. You know, things must be said. How do you deal with that? It must be very difficult.
Well, we've just kind of let them just get on with it, really. I mean, we've been very, very lucky in the fact that we've always been in areas where, so when Rory was at Stoke, when I'd say the kids would remember him playing, because I don't think they would remember him playing at Southampton or Sunderland. No. And we went and they were in a very small village primary school, 10 in the class. So I don't really think, it wasn't like he was anything special. Mm-hmm. You know, they were with, most of them were farmers or, you know, just sort of regular guys.
Yeah.
And they didn't really know anything to do with football, really. So it was...
Yeah. Okay. So So moving on from that, we're talking about the kids. What about you as a spectator? I mean, I'm going to talk about your boys in a moment and your girl. But in terms of watching a game, and I'm not saying that Rory ever did get any abuse, but if you hear stuff, and you must hear, and maybe not even at the game, maybe you're out having dinner and some drunken idiot comes up and says something. I don't know whether that's ever happened to you, but that must be difficult, and especially if the kids are there.
I'm normally the drunken idiot.
And you're normally the one slagging Rory off. No, don't.
No, I have to say, I can remember Tottenham away when he was at Southampton, and I was with his aunt, and just one guy just wouldn't give it. He just wouldn't. And he wasn't constructive, and it was just, and he just wouldn't shut up. And I was sitting there like holding my seat, and I was thinking, I'm not going to say. But in the end, his aunt turned around before me, and she is Irish, as you can imagine, and gave hell for leather. So I thought, well, I don't need to say anything now. It's all been said. And then the only other time that I remember, well, two times actually, when I was with the kids, Rory got sent off against Man City.
Remember it very well.
And there was a lot of unrest in the crowd, and Liam, my eldest, burst into tears. So I had to just take him away back into the room. And then the cup final, you know, the FA Cup final.
Yeah.
And that whole day, I don't know whether you remember and whether you even went, but they took photos.
What are you talking about?
They took photos of everybody at every minute in the ground.
Yeah, yeah.
So obviously you put your seat number in, you go. So afterwards, the kids were like dead excited, put the seat number. Just so happened that the minute that was on the eldest seat was the minute that City scored.
Oh.
So he's there crying his eyes out. So it's the only two times really I've been affected in the crowd. Other than that, I am quiet. I do keep quiet.
Yeah, yeah.
I do.
Just to sort of combine the two things. And by the way, have you been a physio since? I mean, other than for friends and things like that, have you had a full-time job at any other sports clubs?
Yeah, not at the sports clubs. I've worked in David Lloyd Health Centre.
Oh, right, okay.
And I've now got a couple of athletes who, well, one who's incredibly, you know, she's just represented GB. And I'm really enjoying that because I do enjoy the sports side of it.
Yeah.
Obviously, with having the kids and moving about, I've just done bits and bobs, self-employed here, there. But yeah, I'm still working.
But so let's, if you don't mind, I want to talk about injuries, because injuries are, from what I understand, it's always a strange thing, because a player gets injured and they're in the first team. They can't really be around the team all that much. There's a kind of a sense of, oh, God, this could happen to me. And they go and do their rehab and all that. But for you, I mean, I know that Rory, of course, was on loan at Stoke from Sunderland. Stoke played Sunderland and he got a really bad leg break. Now, suddenly that puts your whole future income, as far as you know, at threat. It puts him in a difficult position. You know a little bit about what's going on. Well, you know a lot about what's going on. So how does that feel at home? How does that affect the atmosphere at home? I mean, you're going to talk for yourself, but how did that feel at the time?
Well, that actual day, I'd actually come down because I was staying with my mum, and so I decided to go to the game. So I was a little bit late to the game, and then I sat and I could hear, I heard the break.
Yeah,
it was,
yeah.
And it was obviously early doors. So I went down and was with my brother. Went down, and Winnie in the kit room, I just looked at it, and where I saw it was so low down, I was thinking, you know, because he was 30, I was thinking, this is going to be, you know, hard to come back from. But I knew his mentality, so I was thinking, well, he's got me, but from that minute, we never ended up going back to Durham. So I hadn't intended to move down immediately because, obviously because of schooling for the kids and preschool.
Yeah.
So I was just going to wait anyway. So it was just a case of moving with my mum, actually, for the first couple of weeks because he had an op, couldn't do anything, drive. But then we ended up renting somewhere very close to Stoke for the fact that the physio lived on the same estate and he could take him in to and from work every day. For the fact that I was pregnant with the third and I had three and a one-year-old. So, but yeah, that was... It was a tough time, that, but I have to say, Rory's really, he doesn't really bring work home.
Doesn't he?
No, he's really good at, don't get me wrong, like if he's had a bad day or a thing, he might stew for a little bit, but once he's home and he's with his family, it's all forgotten. And maybe that's because we don't allow him to. I just have always just got on with things and not dwelled on it and not overthought about the money, because we will be all right. You know, I'm a big believer in whatever happens, happens for a reason.
Yeah, yeah.
And that break was weirdly probably one of the best things, because obviously Stoke stuck by him and hopefully you know, people realise he repaid them with
years
of service.
And it's strange because you mentioned the thing about Jim Smith being very supportive of you at Derby moving to Southampton. Yeah. Of course, that was quite a big thing that happened at Stoke because he was on loan, possibly going to be moving.
Yeah.
And Stoke said, right, he's broken his leg, but we'll still have him and we'll cover it.
Yeah.
Now, that must help warm your heart towards a club when they
weirdly, you were talking about, obviously, when we came to Stoke is the only team where we came before, watched a game, met the manager, Tony, and I can remember him sitting down and I was there, and it's the first manager I've met when the transfer dealing was going on. He said, if you're happy, I'm happy, but if you're not happy, he's not going to be happy. Mm-hmm. And I just remember thinking then, this club is got your best interests at heart, mm-hmm. you know, and they really did stick by him. They were phenomenal. I couldn't speak highly enough of the owners and anything at that time in Stoke. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, and
obviously
still there. So
yeah, I just wondered from a point of view of being a physio at a football club. I mean, there are injuries, aren't there, once that would have ended a career that can now just be fixed, can't they? There are sort of
phenomenal
cruciate
now.
Ligament
yeah.
injuries, for instance, used to end a player's career, didn't they?
Yeah, and there was
amazing things they can do now.
There was times at Derby where there was a couple of academy boys who done the cruciates and things like that, and you think, God, they're not playing, they never made it, you know. Whereas now, a cruciate is ten a penny. Like, you know, the surgeons now, everything is so much more advanced that I think anything you would think you got a shot of playing again, really, no matter what injury.
And you can
be
out for 6 months, but you do come back as strong as before, with injuries that would have ended a career. When I was very young, I was actually in the church choir with a lad who went on to be a pro footballer called Danny Thomas, who played for Coventry and Spurs.
And England, didn't he?
And England a couple of times, yeah. And he had a really bad knee injury where I think it was at QPR when he was playing for Spurs, and a player went into the side of his knee and he was down for a long time, and that was the end of him. And he actually became a physio, Danny, I think at West Brom. But that injury, you think now, you know, obviously he's as old as I am, but you think now for kids today, that injury, he'd be out for 6 months, but he'd be back, he'd have a career still.
I think the only thing I will say is with the big injuries is sometimes it's harder for the player to come back mentally, mm-hmm. because they're always worried that it might
that something like
happen,
that might
again.
Happen again.
And I think it takes time, and I think you've got to have that strong mentality. I mean, I wouldn't know, obviously, from a manager's point of view or a player's point of view, that side. But I would say certainly I've seen people after injuries where they're just missing that edge that they had.
A little bit of pace,
just
maybe,
a little,
or something
just,
like that.
It's almost like that.
Fear?
It's, but it's also that nastiness. You know, maybe if you're going in for a tackle.
Recklessness.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that is. So I would say when you're coming back from an injury, I would say that the actual psychology of it is just as important as the rehab nowadays.
I mean, they often use the phrase, "Are they not ready yet?" And you're never quite sure as a fan what that means. Are they physically not ready? Are they mentally not ready? Are they not giving the stats that you want from the, you know,
well,
the blitz test?
As a physio as well, you have to deal with the whole person as well, don't you?
You have to
bring the whole person.
But you can do it all in training. But it's that game, no matter what sport it is, it's that game day. And you will never ever emulate that until you've got through probably 5-10 matches, I would say, after a serious injury.
Until
you actually think, hang on a minute, I'm okay.
Yeah, and you wonder sometimes if managers have 5 games to give somebody.
Because also, you say these days they might use the reserves or they might use the youth to get the. But it isn't the same.
No, no.
In my opinion, it isn't the same.
No.
Well,
no.
You have to worry, don't you, about that young lad at Liverpool who had that bad injury, didn't he? Just
Harvey Elliott.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he'd only just broken in, hadn't he? Only just broken through.
Such
and
you, a phenomenal
and,
player as
and
well.
And then
yes.
you wonder
I've
whether.
I've seen him, you know, he's played with my eldest in England and I've seen him first-hand play and he's. He will come. You know, Liverpool, I think, have got one of the best medical teams.
Well,
you just talked about young players getting injured, and you were talking about how different clubs welcome you in different ways, and, you know, are more more pleasing environments to be in. Now, of course, you have two boys now playing or on the books of clubs.
Yep.
So you've got Finn, haven't you, at Burton?
Yep.
And you've got Liam at Manchester City. Now, Chris and I were talking about this before, you know, because obviously as parents you think about that and you think about... You have more knowledge of the game. That might be a worse thing. That might make you think, I don't want to let my... Well, no, you might think he's going to get a big disappointment if it goes wrong. Do I want to put him in that position? So you've got two in that position. And so I'm interested in that. But also in some ways, your influence on the club they go to is slightly bigger because they're younger. And how do you assess where's a good place for them to go?
I'll have to say I really didn't push them into it because I have, like you say, seen firsthand, and it's tough. It's tough, and not many make it. But we were always under the impression that they would go to their local club. So wherever we were at that time, they would go to the local club. And then if something happened longer down the line, then obviously they were old enough then to have And so Liam and Finn both started at Derby, which was the local club, and they went. They were both scouted. On just like the Sunday League, you know, the race course, and asked to go and train, and they both spent from the under nines to the under 16s at Derby. Mm-hmm. Liam obviously was then asked by, I think there was a few clubs, obviously we subsequently learnt afterwards, but if you, like interested, but unless there's a bid accepted, you don't really hear about it. He didn't have an agent. Right? His agent was his dad. So it, we did. The club don't have a right to tell you if you haven't got an agent, if you're that age.
Oh, is that right?
So we just, you know, and we weren't that bothered. So then obviously we found out that a bid had been accepted by City, and we sort of just said to Liam, what do you want to do? But obviously you sort of say, really, you've got to go and speak to them, because if a bid's been accepted, you know that. So we took him up there, but he couldn't make up his mind. But we weren't going to make his mind up for him. I think, you know, part of him really wanted to stay at Derby. That was his sort of dream, to stay, get into the first team, to break into it.
So how old was he when he went to
16? 16. Yeah, and it was literally just after his GCSEs, the bid was accepted. And so he finished his GCSEs. We had a week together as a family on holiday, and then he went and moved into Diggs. So it was all quite quick. I cried for about 3 months.
I feel like crying now.
I literally walked past his bedroom every single day. I go, I can't go. He's not there. But I knew he was in good hands. And I have to say, you know, we did toy at the time of moving up. Rory was very keen to move up, and so that he had that 16 to 18 still with us. And still, but we had other children. And we looked and we gave them the decision, and one was like, I don't want to do it. One was, I do want to do it. And then they kept swapping, and the daughter was like, well, I'll come if we can take the cat and the dog. And I was just like, it was all getting very... So in the
well,
end...
it's an opportunity to get rid of the cat and the dog,
isn't
it? Anyway.
In the end, we just said, we'll give him till Christmas. If he's really homesick, if we were struggling, then we'd think about it. But actually, he was thriving and he loved it. And we were still seeing him. He was coming home every single weekend, so... It was great.
I like the idea that Manchester City have put in a bid for Liam Delap, a cat and a dog to move.
Two dogs. Yeah, no.
My experience with my sons only play football, school football, you know, and I was interested that Nick was telling me that once a young player signs for a club at maybe 14, 15, 16, that they don't play that school football anymore. They get taken out of that atmosphere and put in another. But my experience with my sons was going to school games, you know, and angry dads. And, you know, I always used to make a point of going on the pitch and thanking the referee for his time, you know, just because no one else was doing it.
Well, it was always me, obviously, because Rory was obviously, whenever the matches were, Rory was playing or coaching.
Yeah.
So I was just stood alongside a lot of angry dads as an angry mum. But we always made sure that he played his school matches, actually. That was one of the conditions.
Yes.
So he continued to play for school.
Right, so Liam did.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. That's great. Yeah. So, I think that's always the thing. You stop playing with your friends. Do you stop enjoying the game? But I suppose that is in the nature of the way becoming a professional works.
Yeah, and to be honest, I think we just sort of said that is school, a bit like the academic side. The school was first, and actually... You know, if that was suffering, then he wouldn't be playing. So he played all his school matches up until he left, and In fact, his last ever school match, he fell down a rabbit hole and did his ankle just before the League Cup final. So he missed it because he was in a boot for Derby.
Oh,
but
I thought you were going to say he fell down a rabbit hole and met the Mad Hatter.
Yeah. So, but you know, he didn't miss out on anything like that.
Okay. Did you ever get, because of course Rory was coaching at Derby when the boys were there, wasn't he? I mean, did you ever get, because parents are, obviously they always think their kids are the best, did you ever get any of that sort of snidey, this is nepotism, they wouldn't be in the team, either Finn or Liam would be in the teams if it wasn't for the fact that they, or did they just not dare say it to you?
I'm sure they did behind my back, yeah. I'm absolutely convinced. But no, I think, I don't know, because no one ever said it to my face. No. I'm sure there was a bit of that, but Rory was always very keen and would never want to sort of get in the way. So he always stayed well out of the boys' coaching roles. You know, luckily it wasn't the same age groups and stuff, but he was quite conscious of he didn't want that. But certainly didn't to my face, but I'm sure there was a lot of back stuff.
Well, hopefully you'll have many more years of being attached to football in one way or another.
Yeah,
with Liam and with Finn.
Yeah.
Well, the final thing, just obviously I've seen recently that first of all, I wanted to ask you about Liam's first senior goal, because I texted you straight after he scored, if I remember.
Well, I was on my own in the kitchen and I was watching it on my iPad. And then, of course, because it was a bit of a lag, everyone kept ringing me. And so I actually missed it because they're all ringing me because they'd watched it. And obviously, that was fab. Yeah, I mean,
and it was the same for Nick last night because there was a rerun of Celebrity Antiques Roadshow.
There was.
Just ringing him up the whole time.
Yeah. And just one other thing very quickly before we finish is I recently read, and of course these things are said all the time, something linking him with Borussia Dortmund and £17 million. And I mean, do you just have to treat that as complete nonsense?
No idea. Yeah. Like, literally, I think you're always the last to know in football, to be honest, but we haven't got a clue. But it's more importantly for him and for Finn, as long as they're enjoying it and as long as they're fit and healthy, I'm not bothered.
Yeah. And Neve's the best of the three of them anyway, isn't she? Yeah.
Joyful girls and hormones, yeah.
And final question, did Liam and Finn actually support a particular team?
I think they always supported the dad, but Liam was actually asked this question the other day while I was with him, and he actually did say Stoke.
And that's the end of the interview!
Yeah.
Helen, thank you so much. That was really, really interesting stuff. So thank you very much to Helen Delatt. That was great fun, and we'll speak to you next week.
GreatBigOwl.com Podcast Network.